I get labeled, I get made fun of on Bitcoin Twitter. Like, you think Bitcoin Twitter is tough, is nasty? Serbian Twitter is really nasty.
Welcome to Live with Bitcoin, where we delve into the human side of Bitcoin by focusing on Bitcoiners' personal transformations and life stories. I'm your host, Vivian. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like and want to support our mission on shining light on the human side of Bitcoin, remember to subscribe to this channel, leave a comment, or send a few sats from link in the description. Today, our guest is Prince Philip of Serbia, and he's also the Chief Strategy Officer at Gen3, a global financial technology company. After a 13-year career in traditional finance, through his foundation in Serbia, he promotes financial literacy, the arts, cultural heritage, and technology. Welcome, Prince Philip.
Thank you, Vivian. Thank you for having me. It's good to see you.
Glad we find this opportunity together to chat. Most of the times you're on podcast as the CSO of Gen3, which we will talk about. But on Live with Bitcoin, we need to dial it back a little bit. Let's talk about Serbia. For most of our audience, including myself, may not know much about the country, the culture, people, the food, or even like personality traits. So what are some things that you think best to represent Serbia in a nutshell that people have to know?
Oh, there's so much to Serbia. To put in a nutshell, I think Serbia is a very misunderstood country. And I think Serbia has a lot to offer. From a agricultural standpoint, I think Serbia is underrated for its food. I think Serbian food, its cuisine is underrated. You don't really get to see many Serbian dishes around the world or restaurants around the world. So I think that's an area that people should when they come to Serbia are always pleasantly surprised that there's that we have a lot of great produce here. So a lot of really fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, and fresh good quality meat. We pride ourselves on having excellent meat. So I think Bitcoin has loved that fact. I mean, we our main two meats are lamb and pork, but we have fantastic beef. And there's a lot of grass-fed animals here. So they're very happy animals and happy consumers. and the produce here, I think it's fantastic because it's very seasonal. We buy most of our food from the market. And these are old-style markets where it's pretty much straight from farm to stall to your table. So right now, it's probably my favorite season. You have a lot of the blooming fruits and you get a lot of colors in the market. So you get a lot of apricots, plums, cherries, raspberries, blueberries and stuff all coming out right now. And Serbia is famous for its berries. I think at one point, Serbia was one of the biggest, if not the biggest. I think maybe, I don't know if it lost its crown of being the largest exporter and producer of raspberries, but at one point it produced a third of the world's raspberries. But I think now Chile has overtaken it. So Chile's a lot bigger. I mean, I could keep on going on about the food right now. Lots of good leafy vegetables as well. I mean, everything really. I'm really blessed to have such a fertile, to live in such a fertile country.
What is your favorite Serbian dish?
Apart from just straight up meat, cooking it by itself, which is my favorite thing to do, I'd say if it's a dish like a recipe, I'd say sarma. Sarma is what I was talking about, like the cabbage when they wrap it and they stuff, and it's basically stuffed cabbage with meat, usually 50% pork, 50% beef, but I kind of like it when it's with beef.
Good to know. Now I know what to get next time I'm in Serbia.
I guess as a country, the culture is something that's also, I think, misunderstood around the world. That it's predominantly 90% Orthodox, Serbian Orthodox, Orthodox religion. That's a type of Christianity. It's very similar to Russian, to Romanian, to Bulgarian, to Greek Orthodox. It's still very much a part of our lifestyle. Maybe less so in Belgrade. You get a little bit more liberal attitudes in Belgrade. But when you go into the countryside, everyone goes, gathering in the church on Sundays and on red calendar days, that's saint days. So you'll see on the calendar that the day is colored in red. Those are highly celebrated here. And I think the church, is a big part of the culture here.
Never thought I'd be asking this on the podcast, but here I go. What was it like growing up in a royal family or within the royal context? I assume there must be some sort of difference.
I was born in exile. My father was born in exile as well. So the monarchy here was abolished in 1945. Just as the Second World War was ending. That's when the partisans which was led by General Tito took over as the dictator of Yugoslavia. And obviously, that goes against monarchy, and they stripped us of all our private property, and they exiled us, kicked us out of the country, and they made all the Karadjordjevich, that's the dynasty that I'm part of, is the Karadjordjevich dynasty, made all the living members of the Karadjordjevich as enemy of the state. My father, at 2 months old, was, because he was born in 1945, was made enemy of the state. I mean, you know, it's very dangerous, two-month-old. We were never part of being an official royal family, so part of a functioning royal family. I have almost two lives. I have my normal life. I've been brought up in London, just living slightly privileged life, going to good schools and having some sort of financial privilege. But at the same time, you know, being free to do kind of what I wanted, as I was not constrained to a system or to an official monarchical, constitutional, or even absolute monarchical system. So, and even back then, when I was a kid, I was before 18 years old, we didn't really ever expect to move back to Yugoslavia at all. But it wasn't until when Milosevic got ousted in 2001, and that was a memorable occasion. He was ousted. He was toppled in around October 2000, and that's when our family were kind of officially invited back to the country. And my father moved into the palace in Serbia. Memorable occasion was being invited, coming back, and actually seeing the palace for the first time.
How old were you?
Yeah, that's a good question. That was 2001, so I was 19 years old. And it was just like, I didn't really believe what was happening and didn't expect that this was ever going to happen. So it was a bit of a shock to me. And I wasn't brought up to expect this at all. So I had mixed feelings. I was like, well, I kind of like my life in London, but this is nice.
Your story remind me of the movie Princess Diary, where the girl was brought up in a ordinary family and nobody told her she was a princess. And then when she hit like high school and her like royal grandma come to pick her up and start to spend time with her and put her in the palace. I think that's how the movie went. Well, obviously in this case, you knew where you came from, but the life kind of had a quick turn.
It did. I mean, when we were living in London, we were attending a lot of functions with the diaspora, because Serbia has a huge diaspora. If you think that during the Second World War, a lot of the monarchist royalists had to leave the country for their own lives, because the communists here were actually killing the bourgeoisie class, the educated class, by the thousands. I mean, I can't give you a specific figure, but I think about 60,000 to 80,000 bourgeoisie were murdered in a number of years, basically. So a lot of the royalists, I believe, they moved all over the world, just like ourselves. We had to flee the country for safety. And a lot of them ended up in London. A lot of them ended up in Germany, Australia, in America and Canada. Actually, Canada as a country has the biggest population diaspora, and as a city, then Chicago has the biggest population of diaspora. There's about 7 million Serbs in Serbia, I think. And I believe it's about 6.57, and there's about 5.5 to maybe even 6 million diaspora around the world.
Wow, yeah. That's almost the same amount as the population.
It's huge. It's because that was the first load happened during after the Second World War. Then again, there was and then there was some that's happening between the Second World War up until the 90s. But then in the 90s, when after Tito died in 1980 and the breakup of Yugoslavia, and the subsequent wars in the 90s, there was a lot more immigration. A lot of more emigration leaving Serbia then as well.
Tough history. So much going on.
I mean, we could spend hours talking about the economical and political fallouts.
Geographically, it's tough to be there, to be honest. It's get caught in the middle of everything.
Exactly. If you look at a map over an evolutionary map from, let's say, from the 12th century up until now, you can see it like how many the countries pop up and disappear and how it shifts and moves over time very dramatically. And what's actually quite cool when you see this evolutionary map is like there was at one point a big blob, which was the Ottoman Empire for a few hundred years. But then in 1804, out of nowhere, thanks to my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Kara George, who led the first uprising of, against the Ottomans, liberated Serbia. And so in the sea of this Ottoman blob, all of a sudden this little country, Serbia, just appears, boop, like that. And that started that he basically is known as the father of modern Serbia. So I'm quite proud of that.
I feel like for places that have gone through turbulent times, a common trait of the people from those places they're very resilient and hardworking and kind of fluid in the sense that because opportunities are so rare and peace is rare. So you do whatever, right?
Yeah, this is actually a topic that comes up quite a lot with my wife, because she lived, and a lot of the population here, Yugoslavia, endured some pretty tough sanctions in the 90s. So when you have these sort of sanctions in your small country, and you were somewhat dependent on international trade, as Yugoslavia was before during its socialist years, 60% of its trade was with the West. So when the sanctions were imposed on it in the 90s, that was quite tough. But then Serbs, being very resilient individuals, very resourceful, very intelligent individuals, did what they could, and they became very hardened by that whole conditions that they were placed in. So you still see it today. You can still see people who are you still trade, like when you go to the market, with people who are sort of hardened by those 90s times.
Let's talk about the role of a modern prince then. What responsibilities come with your title, and how do you approach it? Because you, like you said, you lived a separate life and you still have a day job.
We don't have an official role here. We are recognized as a royal family by a lot of people. Because the Karađorđević dynasty here ruled for several decades, on and off. And we are still recognized by the people, because the monarchy was abolished and people still don't recognize that. So I'd say about 30, you know, anywhere between 20 to 40% of the population will instantly have monarchy come back to the country. So in that respect, we are have an unofficial duty, an unofficial role. And we get invited to a lot of places, and we like to make appearances in a lot of places, and we like to give support to a lot of people. And this is something that my wife and I decided that we would, given that I was getting back in touch with my Serbian roots, thanks to her, thanks to finally finding love in a Serb, which was just perfect. And she brought me back in touch with my roots. Thanks to our work and our popularity and all the PR that we've been doing, thanks to some close friends of ours that have been helping us out of goodwill, we've just opened up our foundation, and we're just trying to find new projects. And our foundation will be focused on like cultural heritage, health issues, and also to somehow find initiatives to reverse the brain drain that we have in this country, where Serbia has experienced a huge issue of net out migration of people leaving due to economical circumstances where they find, where they get educated. Serbs are highly educated people. The schools here, the education system here is actually pretty decent, and universities are really good. We have good professors, but then also they get good positions. They get, they might go abroad to get educated as well. Not saying that the education these days is the best all over the world, but they still learn the, and they get a taste of the outside of an economic standards outside of Serbia, and like in more westernized countries, and they end up wanting to move there, which is sad. And so that we do have a lot of money being sent back here, but I think one day that will be reversed. I think Serbia has a lot to offer. I think it can be more competitive. Figure out some ideas of try to make it more competitive so individuals won't want to leave, and actually stoke that Serbian entrepreneurial mindset that we used to have before, that was extinguished a lot during the socialist times, when obviously socialism does not promote entrepreneurialism, but Serbs were very entrepreneurial people, very creative and resourceful people, and I want to stoke that that movement again. So there's a lot of things that my wife and I are going to be working on in the next few years.
Wow. It feels like Serbia as a country needs better PR.
Yes. And I think recently, I think Serbia's had a bit of a resurgence back in its popularity globally, thanks to people like Djokovic. You know, the tennis player who's number one tennis player in the world and the best tennis player that's ever existed, who's won everything and won the most of everything, Grand Slams, and is also just a freedom fighter as well, resisted getting the vax. And he was he was celebrated for that and for showing the resistance against this, I would say, the COVID tyranny that was happening around the world. And recently there was a move, because also Serbia then recently have, during the Ukraine-Russia conflict, Serbia did not impose any sanctions on Russia. I mean, most European countries, I think all apart from Serbia, have not imposed, and maybe Turkey as well, have not imposed sanctions on Russia. But we didn't want to do that because we may or may not believe in Putin, but Russians are our brothers. They are Orthodox brothers in faith, religion, and we are very close to them. Also, not just socially, but also economically as well. And we're just like, we didn't impose those sanctions, and also, but there are political people, politicians within our country that also want to move us closer to the European Union. There's a lot of games happening there. It's like, if you want to be part of the EU, you need to impose sanctions. So these games are being played against us, and we wanted to just impose a very neutral approach, a bit like Switzerland.
It's so tough. It's really tough. Get caught in all of these conflicts, and even in Bitcoin, good luck trying to be friends with everyone. You have the day job life and work as a professional now in Bitcoin, coming from a traditional finance background, and then you still have your heritage. And I'm really glad. It seems like you're really, really passionate about this, and now you've had the opportunity to get back to your roots and really grow bonds and connection. And it seems like over time you're gonna be the worst Serbian speaker in the family in the coming years.
that's one way of putting it. Yes, that's a good thing. Actually, that's a really good thing.
What is it like to live these two lives together, and how do you see them coexist?
That's a really good question. I like having a purpose and meaning in life, and I think this is something that I didn't have this philosophy, let's say, about 10 years ago. I was a little bit more left leaning, and as a little bit like a little carefree, high time preference, instant gratification. Still working in a bank, I was working in finance and asset management, making okay money, but I was free to do what I wanted, and I was just basically living to work, working hard and playing hard. And I'm glad that's changed. I think because that had no future. I had no future at all. Yes, I worked. I had a philosophy of working. I was living in London. I was very independent and had all that. But I didn't really believe much in marriage or having family and stuff. But that all changed when I met my wife and we had our son. And when I met my wife and had our son, then I realized when I was holding my son in my arms, I was like, and he was a beautiful boy, and he still is a beautiful boy. Very cheeky, but just what a boy, Stefan. And just thinking, I have to make things good for this guy. I have to, this, you know, the way that the Karo Georgievich dynasty is right, the family is right now, the what we need to make this better. And it made me more, I guess, it turned me more into the family guy, I guess if you're looking at my political compass, it started to go more right at that point. And at that point, I'd already discovered Bitcoin, but I wasn't really into Bitcoin, as in, like, I wasn't a Bitcoiner yet. I hadn't actually studied it enough yet. But it wasn't until when I moved to Serbia, and I was still working my job in London, and then I understood what Bitcoin actually properly meant, and the concept of proof of work, that my philosophy really changed. And that really kind of made me realize that I guess the meaning of life is sacrificing yourself, working now for a better future for the next generations. Otherwise, we're just, you know, what's the point of living? We're just going to destroy everything and leave nothing for our children. And this is what I also maybe wake up to be more of a monarchist as well, because, you know, and in an absolute sense of monarchy, you know, the governance model is actually quite brilliant in that sense. Yes, you have issues that you could have a bad egg come along and try and destroy things, but actually the idea that a monarchy is all about having a very long time horizon. And this is why a lot of the absolute monarchies in around the world, and I'm looking at the places like in the Arab Peninsula, like Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates, are doing so well right now and so highly developed and are economically growing so strong. It's because they don't have short-term election cycles. They're not having cycles they're not worried about electing a new leader every 4 or 5 years. And that leader is not worried about getting elected every 4 or 5 years and trying to see how he can stay in power. And while he's in power, he's trying to use up as much of his connections within power to try and enrich himself and all that. You know, it's incentivized. So now with the monarchy, you are actually incentivized to actually leave as much as possible for your children and for your children's children. So you actually want to tax your people and take as little away from your people as possible, because you want your family to exist millennia from now. And in order to do that, you have to make sure you don't plunder from your people. And that's why the governance model of monarchy is works quite well. But, you know, you tell that to a neoliberal democratic republican, and he would laugh at you and say, oh yeah, but that's absolute monarchy is just another form of dictatorship. Yeah, might look like it, because there's one person in, well there's no voting, but there's a succession plan, and that's what's important. It's more closely linked to human nature, to human action, to natural order. And that whole idea of giving birth to successors, and them giving birth to successors, and that continuation, is that you have to make sure if the family is taken care of, then the country is taken care of. It's like an example, really. So that's what I was woken up to in the last few years, thanks to Bitcoins, thanks to moving here, thanks to understanding what my family were fighting for many years ago. And then going back to your question about what my juggling that with my work life is like, I think it's important that we work. I think it was good. We got to have meaning. And then once I put the hours into studying Bitcoin and realizing that, you know, that it was it, that there was nothing else but Bitcoin in terms of money, my position at my asset management job became painful. I didn't really believe. I didn't believe that I didn't have the motivation of working there any longer. It was all a bit of a farce to me. And I thought, yeah, this is all a bit ridiculous now. March 2022, so just over 2 years ago, my wife and I were invited onto the biggest TV evening show here, which is the Ivan Ivanovich show. And we met with him, the host. He lives on our road, actually, 2 or 3 days before. And he found out that I'm a Bitcoiner. And anyway, so we got to know each other. And then 3 days later, we did the recording. And while I was talking about my job, I wasn't really passionately talking about it. He interrupted me and says, it's now a good time to talk about crypto. And that's when I said, well, it's not about crypto. It's all about Bitcoin. And then 3 minutes later I was speaking about, I did that 3-minute speech about Bitcoin that came out of nowhere. I just didn't expect that at all. And that then obviously went viral when it was aired. And next thing I know, Bitcoin Twitter picks up on it. And I'm then on my first ever podcast, which is Daniel Prince's Once Bitten podcast. And he took me under his wing and introduced me to a lot of people, which is great. Next thing I know, I'm then speaking to Safety in the Moose, to Safe. I'm like, wow, I've his book helped me orange pill me, and I'm listening to a few of his podcasts in the days as well. So, and then I'm on his podcast. I'm like, this is surreal. Next thing I know, I'm getting invited to go to Miami, and I meet you in Miami actually as well, but also I meet Samson, and Samson is like, hey, I just started a company called Jan 3 and we're looking, Our mission is for hyper Bitcoinization and for nation state adoption. Do you want to be a part of it? I didn't think much. I just said yes. I didn't give it any thought at all. I just said yes on the spot. And so, a few months later after that, I gave up my fiat oriented job and became a full-time Bitcoiner with a Bitcoin job with working in Jan 3, which is a company that's focused on pushing nation-state adoption, hyper-Bitcoinization. But we have our products, like, which is right now we just released Aqua Wallet, which is a fantastic new self-custodial wallet.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Aqua Wallet. I've been using it ever since it came out. Works as wonder, right? And it's funny that you mentioned the whole monarchist. Is that the word?
Monarchist, yes.
Yes. It's so funny in Bitcoin. I saw a tweet the other day, and they were saying how Bitcoiners are the only group of people who the vegans and then the carnivores can sit on the same table and have a dinner and still have a good time and not fight each other. And it's the same in Bitcoin, like anarchists can sit together with monarchists and eat steak together and have a good time. It's just interesting to conceptualize and visualize this mental picture.
A lot of Bitcoiners actually like the idea of monarchy, and they see the benefits of the government's model. Of course, most Bitcoiners are anarcho-capitalist, are Rothbardians at core, but then they understand, some of them, even some very influential Bitcoiners, have actually become quite monarchical. I think that a bit of both can actually work. I think that at the end of the day, what would be a perfect structure would be an absolute monarchy, but in an anarcho-capitalist back setting, where the monarchy essentially has somewhat reduced powers, but the monarchy has a tendency to keep the traditions and the customs together, and is the flag bearer, the custodian of a lot of the customs and family values and things like that. Otherwise, I believe that maybe under a pure anarcho-capitalistic setting, over years, people might lose their nationalities and their faith and things like that. And I think, going back to it, people are very much tied to their nationalities, but even more so their faith. And I think you will find it very difficult to strip people of faith and even nationalism. So I think not just having a religion, but having a royal family to champion that has its benefits, I believe.
It's also about perception. From one perspective, you can think of it as control, right? And dictatorship. And on the other side, you can think about it as governance. Because for order to exist, you need some sort of governance.
Exactly. You need to have a governance model that has an absolute, at the end of the day, one arbiter of law, and make it as simple and as cheap as possible. And that would be the crown. And the crown itself would also be subject to that law as well.
You're now the CSO of Jan 3, Bitcoin technology company with the mission of accelerating hyper-Bitcoinization. So what is your main responsibility with Jan 3 as the chief strategy officer?
It's to try and make connections with presidents, prime ministers, leaders, influential people, and to spread and educate about Bitcoin. We believe that there has to be a hand helping the top down on it. And we believe that great starting conversations with people, with leaders around the world, and educating them about how Bitcoin can help them and their people is one way of accelerating hyper Bitcoinization. And it can work in a number of different strategies. And for example, I mean, the Bukele model is something that will probably never happen for a while. I think that's an outlier. That happened 2001, and that will 2021. Though, I mean, never say never. This cycle could bring something completely random. But I think you're seeing more countries around the world, jurisdictions around the world, adopting Bitcoin in different shapes and form. And one of them is actually through mining it. You saw the Kingdom of Oman last year announced that they've invested $1.1 billion into mining Bitcoin. You saw the Kingdom of Bhutan announced last year that they've been secretly mining Bitcoin for, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years with the hydro
capacity.
This is one thing that we've realized at Gen 3, and we one way of orange pilling people and leaders around the world is through mining. And when they understand how Bitcoin can fix its energy, that it's not just a monetary upgrade, but also an energy revolution. I hate saying the word revolution because that's kind of going back on itself. An energy upgrade, I guess, as well.
Elevation.
Elevation, energy elevation, and you realize that you can use the energy in the stranded or the unused or the wasted energy in the country. You can tap that and you can monetize that, and then you can then use that to fund projects, infrastructure projects, and then may tax people less. And when you're doing that, you're making the governments understand Bitcoin, which means that they will start to regulate it properly. And then you can then advise them about that. You can then tell, then they'll understand the difference between Bitcoin and the rest of the, of crypto. And from that, you see, you can, from a top down approach, you're already doing a lot of good for Bitcoin. Meanwhile, while all this happening is that Bitcoin is rip roaring through and unstoppable grassroots phenomena, as I said before, that's growing in many parts of the world, especially in those parts of the world where the fiat system is doing its most damage. So it's growing and it's going to get there no matter what. But we want it to be a peaceful transition. We want there to be for people to realize, for governments and for states to realize that actually Bitcoin is very helpful for humanity, and we don't want to fight people. We want it to be a peaceful transition between the fiat standard to Bitcoin standard, and we have the tools for that. Bitcoin has many opportunities for a lot of developers to work on these peaceful transition projects, things like Liquid and Lightning that help that process.
It doesn't sound like an easy job, given the target audience you're talking to about Bitcoin. Hey,
it's not. It's definitely not an easy job. I'd say that the conversations only happens to those people who already have a little bit of understanding and want to learn more. It's usually the other way around. It's them coming to us, and it's usually also Bitcoiners on the ground around the world. And this is why Bitcoiners are fantastic people. This is why Bitcoiners, they're such hardworking, resourceful people, and they will want help from a company like Gen 3, which we will come in as that sort of top down help. They will come to us and say, you know, we've identified a politician or so-and-so that wants to learn more about Bitcoin. Can you help? And so you're like, yeah, of course. So we start a Telegram group, and then if it's interesting and if it works, then if there's something more substance to that, then we can go out and meet the person, or we can start doing some Zoom calls or whatever. And that's how it mainly happens, is through other Bitcoiners around the world. It's Bitcoiners that make it happen.
It's such noble work Gen 3 is doing on the top-down level. We need the grassroots approach for sure, 100%. But we have all of these people that are empowered to be convinced. And those are the people who actually hold decision-making power and the resources to change at scale on national level, on state level, even on community level, to really make shift on a larger scale, to start building the infrastructures. And it's not necessarily, it's so much legacy work that your team is doing to build a foundation for future generations. If anyone has still dealt with the government or the authority to do anything, like to get an ID card even, like, you know how hurdle you have to jump through to get anything done. To push something so radical, to orange pill a nation, and then to actually have the infrastructure in place, have all the regulations and documents and law passed properly for generations to come. This is so much legacy work and very, very noble thing.
We're not the only ones doing it. We're maybe recognized as the, we have that niche recognition, but there's so many Bitcoiners around the world doing this with other small teams or just doing it on their own. Everyone just trying to reach to their local decision maker or elected individual or something and trying to push for Bitcoin. This is happening everywhere. For obvious reasons, because it's about time we change this legacy system that we have that's working against the majority of individuals around the world.
What is your favorite part of the job?
Wow, I've never been asked that. That's a good question. Learning more about Bitcoin.
Really? That's your favorite part of the job?
Yes. To be honest, yeah, because I have to learn more about Bitcoin. It's made me learn more about the mining side of it. It's made me learn more about dig in. I have to, because I do a lot of podcasts and I want to sound intelligent. So I try and do a lot of reading. And so I try and dig into a lot of books and stuff. And I've read a lot of really good Bitcoin books. So yeah, every time I read a book, it definitely is worth it. And I get a huge kick out of it. The other side I like about it is actually probably the traveling side as well, that I've been to a number of different countries. Because here in Serbia, we have an issue that we don't have that many Bitcoiners here. We do have a lot of Bitcoiners here. A lot of them are very reserved and maybe quiet and they stick to themselves. We have a lot of good developers. But in terms of being open Bitcoiners here, it's still not at the level, let's say, in Latin America or even in America or Germany or some countries, that people here still see it as too good to be true. But that's a good thing, because over here people are actually very skeptical. They're skeptical of anything that seems to be too good to be true. They because of their history, of their hardship that they've had to go through. So their trust towards the state is already not very high. I get labeled, I get made fun of on Bitcoin Twitter. Like, you think Bitcoin Twitter is tough? Is nasty? Serbian Twitter is really nasty. So I have to reserve my Bitcoin tweets to a minimal. Right now I'm not tweeting as much on it, because every time I tweet it, the aggression that comes with it, because people don't quite understand it. They're very private orientated, cash orientated individuals. But then you mention something like Bitcoin and they instantly connected to some digital identity thing or CBDC or something like that. And then they link it to the other shit coins out there and all that. And they just group it all together. But then you have a lot of people who are curious about it, a lot of people who are supporting it, but not vocal enough, because they know that the other half of the country are very aggressively against that sort of change, which is a good thing. But I think in time, through when I improve my Serbian and I can get the message across, I think Serbia is going to be, and it already is going to be, a very in terms of Bitcoin. We have a lot of good minds over here. A lot of people here who are very good at the quantitative disciplines, so like coding, at mathematics, physicists, and things like that. So we have a lot of developers here. There's a lot of Serbians, international Serbians, Bitcoiners out around the world as well that are representing Serbia as well. But within Serbia, I think Bitcoin can do a lot of good for, like any country, it's going to do a lot of good for Serbia. But I think Serbia has a lot to offer for Bitcoin.
Wow, can't wait for Serbia to play a bigger role in the Bitcoin community and vice versa. And to be honest, it is kind of a marketing problem for Bitcoin. They're already critical thinkers, so they think their own, think for their own, for their own sake, have their make up their own mind. So they already have a level of don't trust, verify mentality in it. And if, but of course, there's a resistance coming from the historical background, societal and personal trauma and all that. But if we communicate Bitcoin in a way that's, it is a means to an end. You want stability, you want peace, happiness, connection, and Bitcoin is, it's the means to an end to that end, like freedom and happiness and connection. And it's not, no single solution can solve all our lives' problems, and it would be naive to think that, and including Bitcoin. But I personally believe we don't communicate Bitcoin in a personal way enough to tell people that we as humans, we all want these things just because we share that humanity. We as humans share more than we can possibly imagine. And Bitcoin bring us together through those human needs that we all have. And it helps us to get there, to get closer to these truths, to get closer to our goals and the truths and hope.
Of course.
That's I find most success orange peeling people or talk to people about Bitcoin with the least amount of resistance, just because you can agree that these things we all want.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So, and not many people are going to be technical. Like, I'm not technical, and I'm very conscious about the fact that I'm not technical, to the point that I constantly remember the time when I wasn't a Bitcoiner, and the majority of Bitcoiners these days, they weren't born Bitcoiners, like the newest baby boomer generation in Bitcoin. So at one point, we were not Bitcoiners. And then all over time, we forget about that. And then when we aren't to others, we don't have that same level of compassion or awareness. And then we're kind of all trapped in our own head, knowing all this about Bitcoin, but we need to help them at their level oftentimes. And I'm sure this is something that you do on a daily basis, talking to people who are still on the skeptical side or even just curious. So what is your vision for the future of Bitcoin? More in the sense that, how do you see Gen 3 contributing to that vision?
It's the different strategies that we have. And I think it will be that more politicians and more individuals, because this is what we're focused on, is trying to teach leaders and people in politics about Bitcoin. And I think that's going to become a big, Bitcoin is already been placed on a lot of platforms politically around the world. And we see this now recently in America, now that actually both the Democrats and now Trump especially even mentioned the word self-custody. That is a huge thing in Bitcoin right now, that a former president and probably the next president actually mentioned self-custody and said that we will protect you from your we will make sure that Elizabeth Warren and her goons, I think, will not touch your Bitcoins. He said Bitcoins plural. I think that was funny. So I think you'll find that the work has been done already, just because the fact is that people are waking up. That is happening without the help of Gen 3. But with Gen 3, you know, we want to just tap into as many politicians and speed up that process through different strategies. And I think mining is one of them. Talking about it as a store of value is another thing. And then I think what I believe is the end goal will be as what was designed by Satoshi himself, is an electronic peer-to-peer cash system. And I think we will get there, but we're very far down the line for that. And that's why, you know, Bukele, when he adopted Bitcoin, he didn't do it as as the only form of currency. He actually added it side by side as the US dollar, knowing very well that people still want there's more demand for the US dollar. So I don't think we'll ever get rid of fiat completely. I think, but fiat will then rely more on Bitcoin and use the Bitcoin rails, and fiat will be that spending money, and you will be using Bitcoin as your savings account, as you see in the Aqua wallet, as your store of value. But then over time, you know, I think if you really think in the long term, then all transactions will at one point will happen under Bitcoin. And this will then turn us into a very developed civilization where we're very low time preference individuals and only necessary transactions will happen. And all this useless, unnecessary consumption and transactions that's happening in the fiat world will be a thing that we'll just be looking back at as thinking how uncivilized we actually were. The things in society will change. The architecture will change. Building cars, everything will change. Things will last longer. Architecture will become more beautiful and stronger. Everything will start to work better. And spending Bitcoin, the amount of transactions that will happen in the world that we have today, which is billions per second, will actually be reduced because there's just no need for it. But I mean, that's me looking in 100 years from now. But right now, I think the transition from that right now, it's a great store of value. You know, we are Bitcoiners. We will find solutions to the problems that we have. And this is the beauty about why, about working at Gen 3 is that but this is why Samson had the vision of Aqua, and Aqua is one of those ideas, I guess, visions that Samson had about how to fix and how to onboard the next billion people onto Bitcoin. You have to make it as easy as possible. And, you know, you have Aqua, you have your savings account, which is Bitcoin and main chain, but then you have your spending account, which is, Bitcoin wrapped in liquid, which is also used as lightning transactions as well through atomic swaps and bolts. But then you also have USDT Tether. People want dollar. People want access to dollar, and this is a way of them getting dollar without the capital controls that the dollar actually brings. So there's a need for that, and I wasn't of this mindset when I first became a maxi, but I kind of see the light. I see that the need for it now, and USDT is that bridge to getting more people onto Bitcoin. And they see that, yeah. So this is why Aqua Wallet is so clever, that you have that all together in one place and easy to use. And the user experience is the most important thing. It's a wallet that your grandmother can use. And then on top of that, we have the marketplace, which is something that we'll be working on afterwards. And then we'll have the other products available. We will have, we will be able to have gift cards, debit cards, maybe loans and things like that. So these are the projects that we're going to be working on afterwards on the marketplace. And that's going to be and everything to do with Bitcoin in a self-custodial core. And that's the most important thing, is that it's self-custodial, that you have access to the keys. It's you are responsible for your money. That's what Bitcoin's about. And that's what Aqua is about as well.
It is designed to be very intuitive to use. And that I've enjoyed that aspect of Aqua a lot. It's easy to follow you. It's a wallet that designed with common sense, because just yes. By follow your natural logical just by follow your common sense, you can actually navigate around and do the thing you're supposed to do quite easily. What is like to work with Samson?
Samson is it's an impressive individual. He's a visionary. Samson is very generous, and he's very knowledgeable, and I think it's a pleasure to work with him. He thinks a few steps ahead than most people, and I think it's an honor. It's a pleasure to work with him, and I've learned a lot from him.
Amazing! Twitter I can definitely attest to that. And what Gen3 is doing is absolutely incredible. There's so much work, and I get a little bit of sneak peek at times of how much work that is, and how difficult sometimes to get through the door and push through some of the difficulties that's relevant to all the Bitcoiners. So on behalf of, I guess just me as an individual Bitcoiner, will be benefiting from more politicians, more significant individuals understanding Bitcoin. Thank you for your hard work, and your vision. It's super relevant to all of us. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's a pleasure. Any final thoughts you want to share with the Lightwiz Bitcoin audience?
Learn about your history, the real history. There's always two sides, and study the history of money.
Thank you everyone for tuning into this episode of Lightwiz Bitcoin. I'm your host Vivian, and we'll see you in the next episode.